Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. I recently started reading a book to my mom about a woman's great adventures in a canoe. The book is called Portage, A Family, a Canoe, and the Search for the Good Life by Sue Leaf. Her first big canoe adventure was in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness at the northern edge of Minnesota. It shares 150 miles of international boundary with Canada. And if you look at a map of Minnesota and you focus on all the blue shapes that are dotting it, you're going to immediately understand how it earned its nickname as Land of 10,000 Lakes. Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness has over 2,000 miles of waterways for people who love to canoe. And with the word wilderness in its name, you would probably expect that this place has pristine dark skies. And that is exactly the case. In fact, Boundary Waters is a certified international dark sky sanctuary. But the dark sky certifications don't stop there, because it's also surrounded by two international dark sky parks, Voyageurs National Park in the United States and Quetico Provincial Park in Canada. My guest is Anne Schwaller. Anne has been the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Program Manager on the Superior National Forest for 18 years. She began her career in resource conservation in 1991, working the Salmo Priest Wilderness in Washington State. And then she went on to work in other wilderness areas in Colorado, Montana, and Idaho. And she's worked at the Grand Canyon National Park in Arizona and the Everglades National Park in Florida. She's taken on tasks such as wilderness ranger, trail crew, firefighter, visitor center manager, recreational special uses administrator, and wilderness recreation planner. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Anne Schwaller. Anne Schwaller, thank you for joining me on the Night Sky Tourist podcast from the top of the country. We're really glad to have you here.
Oh, well, great to be here. Thank you.
So let's start by talking about what is Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and where is it for people who have never heard of it?
It's on the Superior National Forest. So it's a management area within the forest. A lot of people, for some reason, think it's a national park, but it is not. So the Superior National Forest, it's about 3 million acres. And so the Boundary Waters is 1,098,000 acres within there. It's in the northeast corner of Minnesota. So Voyageurs National Park is on the west end. Quetico Provincial Park in Canada is on the north, over the border there. And then if you travel east a little bit, there's Grand Portage National Monument. And then you hit Lake Superior. And basically to the south of the Superior National Forest is all kinds of Minnesota state parks and county land. So we're really in a beautiful part of the country in that there's so much public land. Like there are so many recreational opportunities, you know, anything that you would want to do really at different skill levels, basically, I should say, is here. It became federally designated wilderness, which is supposed to be one of the most primitive management areas on public lands, in 1964 with the passage of the Wilderness Act. And then in 1978, we had our own legislation, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Act, which it added more acreage. It gave us our official name. It stopped logging. It stopped a lot of most of the motorized use. You know, there's a few lakes where you can have motorboats, and there's two snowmobile trails. But so it stopped most of that though, and things like that.
So most of
So
it then must be accessed by canoe, I'm assuming, since that's in the name of it.
well, we have trails too, so you can also
Okay.
backpack. The cool thing about designated wilderness in 64, there were about 9 million acres and about 50 some wilderness areas, 54. And now we have almost 112 million acres and 100 or 806 wilderness areas nationwide, but that's still only about 5% of the land base. And most of that is in Alaska.
So it's kind of remote, and that automatically gives you the advantage of being really far away from light pollution. And so tell us what a typical clear night would look like there.
Well, as far as first viewing stars and planets and galaxies, it depends on the time of year, of course. It depends on if the moon is full or not. It depends on if it's cloudy. You know, cold air has basically less moisture in it, so or air pollution than summer air. So winter is often a better time to view. I mean, you can see a lot with the naked eye, but it sounds like you're familiar with that kind of viewing, all kinds of viewing. But yeah, so the cool part is you don't need a bunch of telescopes and whatnot.
And so I guess that gives you like a really clear view of the Milky Way there too.
Yes, which is one of my faves. You can see Andromeda, which is farther, much farther than the Milky Way. I mean, it's hard to see with the naked eye, but you can see it if you try. Of course, meteor showers and then Aurora Borealis,
Oh
often very.
yeah, you guys are far enough north, you probably see that quite a lot.
And you can see them all year round here. And this year, I don't know, I'm sure you know, but it's amazing. Northern Lights, people are seeing them in, you know, Missouri. I mean, this is the year for Northern Lights.
Yeah, there are
So.
people have seen them here in Arizona, which is crazy. I haven't
Yes.
seen them in Arizona, unfortunately,
Arizona.
but people have seen it, yeah.
Yeah. We are far enough away. We have, there's a, you can hear, there's a little bit of light from Thunder Bay in Canada. So if you're in the northeast corner of the Boundary Waters, you can see a little bit of a light dome. You know, light creeps in here and there. Even in this, you know, giant land base, there's still some light that creeps in. So when you think of all of the crowded areas that aren't surrounded with public land, that's probably really difficult.
So you are actually an international dark sky sanctuary, not just a park, but a sanctuary. So can you tell us what is the difference between being a dark sky park and a dark sky sanctuary? Because there aren't very many of those that are around here.
Yeah, the standards were pretty rigorous in the application process and all that, which it should be, you know. The biggest thing is that, you know, it has to be remote. It's a remote location, and it can't have a lot of nearby threats from light pollution. And I guess that's really the biggest thing. And the difference, you know, Dark Sky Park is very similar, but, you know, I went with sanctuary, tried to go with sanctuary because, well, we're not a park. We're a forest. So, and it just made more sense because of the size. And, you know, we are one of the biggest designated wilderness areas in the nation. So, you know, International Dark Sky Association agreed that we should seek the sanctuary status.
When did you
That
get
was
designated?
in 2020. However, I was working on it around 2009.
Wow.
There's all kinds of fears that come with these kind of certifications, you know, like all, you know, people think, oh, I can't do certain things anymore. We can't build businesses near there. Or so there was just a lot of those discussions to have to try to calm those fears, that it really is going to be a benefit to the region, not a detriment. So it just took a little while.
So you're the one who spearheaded this whole effort then, huh?
For us, yeah, the conversation started truly in earnest in like around 2009. We had a celebration between Codico Provincial Park and Superior National Forest because we became our own entities around the same time, and we celebrate that. We were just out. We took a 3-week canoe trip, and we had different people coming and going throughout the whole thing. And we started at Voyageurs National Park and basically ended at Lake Superior and traveled up to Thunder Bay. It was an amazing trip. But anyway, we were just marveling at the night sky, and we were just talking about it, and we were talking about light pollution and light domes, that can be seen from remote areas. And I was talking about how it's part of, wilderness character. There's different qualities. There's untrammeled, there's undeveloped, there's natural, there's solitude and primitive and unconfined opportunities, and just, other features of value. And the night sky could be another feature of value to protect. And that's part of the Wilderness Act. That's part of the law, is to protect these qualities. And I was like, how do we do that? How on earth would we protect the night sky? And the conversations just went from there. And so now Voyageurs National Park is a dark sky park, and Quetico is a dark sky park as well. So now we're kind of like this trio of really dark places.
I know what an effort that can be. So that's
Yeah, because you have to take all the measurements and just all of it, and you have to do that every year, and make sure that you still have those standards in place.
So I haven't personally been to the wilderness there. I'm assuming that it's not necessarily a place that people just casually drive by and decide, oh, let's camp for the night. Am I correct in that, or what is that like? Is this a place that's more out of the way that people need to plan for more?
One of the reasons why I brought up the whole forest and the 3 million acres is because you don't necessarily need to be within the sanctuary boundaries to experience night sky. So, if you lack the skill set or the interest or the comfort in primitive camping, for days and paddling or hiking and or motor boating, we have 23 developed campgrounds that are also very remote. We have 18 rustic campgrounds. We have 254 backcountry sites outside the boundary waters that you can drive to or walk into. And then, of course, we have the wilderness as the most primitive experience. But honestly, you can see dark skies in most places from the forest. Because it's surrounded by so much other public land, it's really dark. And so, people ask me this a lot. They're worried, well, how am I going to see a night sky sanctuary if I can't go into the wilderness? And it's like, oh, don't worry about it. And there are also lots of resorts that now advertise the dark skies, and they have actually made changes to their lighting plans outside their resorts and outside their cabins, so their visitors and their guests can see dark skies right from their resort. And if you go up at the North Shore, if you think about it, there's Lake Superior is right there. There's no light coming from Lake Superior unless you're in maybe Duluth, right? There's so many opportunities. You don't have to go in the boundary waters, So that's really lucky.
So I'm also curious, do you guys offer recreational programs? Do you have an event calendar, or is it because it's wilderness, is it more of a choose your own adventure kind of experience?
Yeah, so if you're going into the wilderness, because it's a primitive area, we don't have events or anything like that inside. But like a lot of these resorts I mentioned, they have their own specific events. We have what we call a naturalist program, and it's in conjunction with some of the resorts on the east side. And they have different events where they go out with telescopes and look at the night sky. There's celebrations that we do. There's a Starry Skies North chapter, like the one you are with, for the Duluth area. And we have a celebration every year now, a whole week. There's an event in Grand Marais up the shore. It's like a festival, Dark Sky Festival. The University of Minnesota Duluth has an observatory and they have little events sometimes. There's little things popping up all over the place. So specifically inside the boundary water, to know, because that's just not part of our policy to have that kind of thing inside, but events about it all over the place. All you have to do is Google.
So you and I have been chatting previously about how popular your area is and how many guests and visitors that you get. And as we were talking before we got started here, this is something that I've thought a lot about over the years. As you read these articles about how different national parks are just overcrowded. So many people want to come, which is amazing. But it creates challenges for our national parks or certain national forests and things like that. And you've mentioned that you've experienced that there at Boundary Waters as well. So what kind of things would you encourage people about in looking at that challenge?
So we have been talking about this a lot as an agency, and we also talked to the other three agencies that have been this, the Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Land Management, and we're the Forest Service. So we talk about this a lot nationally, and you can do very small things, like if you post Instagram photos and stuff, you don't need to say exactly where it is. The photo is still beautiful. If it's not tagged, geotagged exactly the location. For the Boundary Waters, we are one of the most heavily used and marketed and advertised wellness area in the nation. So is the forest. So we don't necessarily need to be discovered. We are discovered. So I guess that would be one of the things that I ask people, if you have these special places that aren't physically and socially damaged yet, maybe try to keep it that way. It's like a long time ago when people would say, post your favorite fishing holes, and they would, and then a month later, there's nowhere to stand. So part of it is, that. Dispersing use, we talk about that a lot. Like I said, we have 23 campgrounds, developed campgrounds, 18 rustic campgrounds, hundreds of backcountry sites outside wilderness. And so we talk about dispersing use all the time. So it's not concentrated just in, like, say, the periphery of the Boundary Waters. If people go in the Boundary Waters, we say, schedule a lot of time, don't rush it. Don't just say, oh my gosh, I only have a couple nights, and then base camp and sit on the periphery. Travel through it. It's kind of designed that the travel model and the quota and the campsites, all of that works in conjunction, and it's designed to move people through and experience it instead of just sitting there like it's a campground. So I encourage people to take enough time and travel through, and that helps move other people through, and it's kind of a leapfrog effect, right? I want people to visit. We all want people to visit. We just want them to visit responsibly, and we talk about light pollution, as far as flooding a campsite with light. Don't bring giant lanterns and fairy lights and have a bonfire at your primitive campsite. Think about your neighbors, and also think about what your neighbors can hear. We get noise pollution complaints as well. It's like, just respect the area, respect the wildlife, respect your fellow campers and the experience they're trying to seek. And I think if everybody keeps that kind of stuff in mind, it's better for everyone, and it's better for them for their next visit.
And
So.
that's what I like to encourage people to do is, I'm for the idea of being spontaneous, but when you're going out into nature, it's always good to think ahead, plan ahead, and really know about the place that you're going to, not only just to keep yourself safe, but also to protect the area that you're going to. I've been out camping in like dispersed camping sites. And there will be people there with their huge RVs. They play their music really loud all night. They put rope lights around the outside of their campers. And I've even been one place where they've had an inflatable movie screen so they could sit outside and watch a movie. And it's like, wow. I mean, I'm glad they're having fun and all, but yeah, what about everybody else? And so, yeah,
Yeah.
just take into account, what is it that you're doing? Where are you going? There are great places that people can go to camp if they want kind of the party atmosphere, but I don't feel like the wilderness is the place to do that. There are reasons that a lot of people go out to camp. It's to get out into nature, to be where it's quiet, to be where it's dark at night. And so, yeah, I really encourage people to think that through. And you gave some really good tips there too on dispersing, don't congregate all in one place, because really, the more people that camp in one place, it kind of diminishes your experience. So yeah, if people go to some of these other places, probably have a much better experience anyway.
I think the whole light pollution is really preventing light pollution is really catching on, and people are understanding the importance. And even in, towns, even in Duluth, where the city of Duluth has started looking at their streetlights and all of that, thanks to IDA and the local chapters, but in the type of intensity of the light and all of that. And I mean, if towns can do it, certainly campers can do it.
Sure,
If
absolutely.
giant hospitals are talking about closing their curtains because of the light coming from their hospital, because we have a new hospital in downtown Duluth that is casting a lot of light, and they're working with the city about that. And if they can do it, surely a camper can do it.
So,
Yeah.
Anne, how can people learn more about the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness? Where will they find information?
Well, you can just go to our website. I would recommend going to our official website because we have the Boundary Waters Trip Planning Guide, which has all of our regulations and rules and tips and all of that in there. And so you can go to www.fs, as in Forest Service, .usda.gov/superior.
Okay.
And you can find everything about the Boundary Waters on there, but also about the rest of the forest and all the other recreational opportunities. So,
Okay.
yeah.
I'll put that link in the show notes so that people can click on it easily. And then also you've mentioned to me a documentary that people might enjoy watching. Can you share what that's called? And then we'll get that in the show
Yeah.
notes too.
Yeah, it's on PBS. And it's called Northern Nights, Starry Skies. And if you just go to pbs.org and go to their video section, and then you'll see it there.
Okay. Yeah, I'll find that and put that in the show notes too so people can click on it. But I would love for them to be able to get access to that and go see that.
We talked about a little bit earlier, that has a really unique twist because it talks more about some of the human history related to dark skies, and Native American history too, which I think is really important. And it's also important to mention that the Boundary Waters and the whole entire Superior National Forest is within a treaty area. So that's an important thing to remember.
That's great. And that's the kind of stuff I love talking about here on Night Sky Tours too. So, well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us. And I know you've got a big job up there in that area, and I've been recently working to deal with some wildfires and stuff. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for joining us here.
Oh, thanks for saying that. And it's been a pleasure meeting you and talking.
Camping, road trips, visiting national parks, star parties, meteor showers, Milky Way season, Scorpius, Sagittarius, and the summer triangle. Summertime was made for stargazing, even if we do have to stay up later before the stars come out to play. It doesn't seem like a proper summer without at least one camping trip, but in my recent camping experiences over the last few years, I'm seeing more and more artificial light lighting up the campgrounds. Even when we camped in primitive campgrounds with no electricity, people were powering these bright exterior lights with their generators. If camping is on your calendar this summer, I invite you to read my article titled Four Sources of Campground Light Pollution. If you're going to go to all the trouble to go camping, take a few minutes to think about how to be thoughtful when you illuminate your space at night so that you can protect the wildlife and give yourself a better view of the stars. My guess is that the stars are going to be way more abundant wherever you camp than they were at home. Check out the article at nightskytourist.com/campground-light-pollution. Or make it easier and find it in the link in the show notes, or go to nightskytourist.com/69. It's time for our night sky tour for early July 2023. Pause the podcast, turn off all the lights, and I'll meet you outside under the stars. It's Milky Way season, which means we're in that perfect place in our orbit around the sun where we can see our own Milky Way galaxy at night. In fact, we can look directly toward our galactic core where there's a supermassive black hole. If you're in a super dark location, you'll be able to spot the Milky Way without anyone having to point it out to you. It's a beautiful, bright streak all the way across the sky. If you're in an urban center, forget it. You're not going to be able to see it. But if you're in a place kind of in between the two, you might be able to spot the Milky Way without knowing that that's what you're seeing. In places that have some light pollution interference, people often mistake the Milky Way for a light cloud streak. I'm going to help you identify the location of the Milky Way by using some constellations, and that will help you to determine whether or not you're actually seeing it. We're going to start by looking toward the south to find one of the most recognizable constellations in the entire night sky because it looks exactly like its name. Its name is Scorpius. Looks like a giant scorpion. Scorpius is huge and the curved part of his tail is just barely above the southern horizon. Can you find him? If not, go ahead and use a stargazing app. Just make sure that you turn the screen brightness down first so that you don't ruin your night vision for trying to see the Milky Way. The Milky Way runs right through the bottom of Scorpius. But honestly, there's even an easier way to find its starting point, and that's to look for Sagittarius. So you got Scorpius. Now look a little bit to the east or the left of Scorpius to find Sagittarius. Light pollution makes it really difficult to see all the stars for Sagittarius, but the most important ones for our exercise are pretty easy to spot. You're going to look for what looks like a teapot with a pointed lid. Try finding it on your own with your naked eye first, but if you get stumped, go ahead and use your stargazing app. When looking at Sagittarius as a teapot, you're going to see the handle on the left, or the east side of it, and the spout is on the right, or the west side of it. Can you see the spout? Now imagine that steam is rising from the spout and stretching all the way across the sky to the north. That is the Milky Way. So as you move your eyes north, northeast from Sagittarius, the Milky Way flows across Aquila, and it has a really bright star named Altair. And then continue toward the north through Cygnus, the swan, and the really bright star that's in the swan's tail, which is called Deneb. And then the Milky Way continues on across Cassiopeia, which looks like a sideways W. That is the path of the Milky Way. And if you follow those constellations each night, you'll either be able to see a faint view of the Milky Way from mildly light-polluted skies, or you might see the constellations and no Milky Way. It does not take very much light pollution to erase the Milky Way from our view. In fact, 80% of people on Earth can no longer see it from where they live. If you get a chance to go to a darker area at night this summer, you will not regret the effort to see this gorgeous home of ours right there in plain sight. And if you go camping, keep the lights off so you and your fellow campers can see it. You can find links to everything mentioned in this episode in the show notes or visit nightskytourist.com/69. That's nightskytourist.com/69. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.